Welcome to podcast 14. Today's guest is Alice Nutter. Alice sang and performed with Chumbawamba for over 20 years. She's played Squats and Benefits and ended up in the pop charts with her song Tub Thumping in 1997. She left the band in 2006 to become a writer. She's written for telly, radio and theatre. In today's podcast, Alice talks about running wild at 14, taking drugs and going to Northern Soul all-nighters, been saved by meeting a bunch of young people who later became Chumbawamba, living in a squat for 20 years, turning down $1 million from Nike for the use of the single Tub Thumping, getting her English A-level at 28, working with Jimmy McGovern of Cracker fame, and how people clapping gives you confidence.
Hello.
Do I have to shout as well?
Just go like that. Okay. There's no exclamation marks in this interview, and it's going to be done very falteringly, and we're going to be sipping water. I've been just to kind of keep the wheels turning.
Sparkling water.
Yes, soda water. Soda water from the
with cucumber.
Yeah. I'm here in Alice Nutter's garden, and Alice Nutter is she's a woman, and she's not a witch. And she was in Chumbawamba for 20 years, and she writes plays and screenplays, and she's here next to us, and we're going to just talk for about an hour. And there's Johnny here as well, and Johnny's... Anyway, I'm thinking maybe I chose the wrong seat because there's a... There's a swing chair over there.
You can swap. Why don't you swap to there?
No, I'm fine. I'm all right.
Sure?
I'm fine. I'm only messing. I'm just getting the wheels turning.
You're just
Yeah. The yabber of the jabber's coming out now.
We're determined to make that.
Johnny, sit there. Get that.
It's good, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
It's a bit like being in Tennessee.
Amazing. Peter, man.
Right.
I like your trousers, by the way.
Oh, thanks. Mustard, yeah. I agree. Mustard.
You're looking relaxed, Johnny. Too relaxed. He's in a swing chair and the temperature is about, I don't know, it's very, very hot.
I looked at my watch then, like that were going to tell me.
Right, Alice, well, I'm intrigued because you were in a band with called Chumbawamba. I don't know what's Chumbawamba or Chumbawamba? How do you pronounce it?
Chumbawamba.
Well,
everybody says Chumbawamba because we're... because we've got Lancashire accents.
Yeah, well, I saw the A and I thought, where's this A?
Because we used to go mad if people didn't spell it right, but we couldn't even say it right.
And what is it? What does it mean?
It was before my time when they named it. They named it early in 80 or 81. They were busking in Paris. Boff, Dan and Midge, who were... early Chumbawamba, they were busking in Paris and they saw some African drummers chanting that, and they decided they wanted some name that nobody understood because they were trying not to be obvious.
Well, it's mysterious and what is it? Whatever.
It's not, yeah, maybe it's mysterious, but as I was saying to you before, people thought they were getting a reggae band at first.
Yeah.
So we were booked for a trade union conference once where... And we came out, because we couldn't play, we always did loads of theatre. And we came out in swimming costumes with brushes and slogans and harangued them for about half an hour. And they all left. And we just played to ourselves.
Oh, crikey.
And we played at, what was that reggae place called in Bradford, early 80s?
International?
It were international, but it was before it moved to a bigger building. And they booked us as a reggae band, and they pulled the plug off.
It happens. I mean, my heart goes out to you, Alice, because we've had similar journeys, only not quite as extreme, possibly. But I do remember us turning up at like rugby clubs and golf clubs, and going in and setting up, and I you're charging into a bunch of men shouting, "I'm the only vegetarian in the room." Oh, you're going to die eating all that crap then. It's rubbish. It's cholesterol.
Well, we were so earnest at that point that we didn't care. We just harangued whoever in front of us.
Yeah.
It weren't even like we were embarrassed about what we were. We all stood absolutely stock still. We're covered in ourselves in red paint and just sort of shouted at them.
Yes.
And if nobody reacted, we... I think we got
you were
a bit
disappointed.
High. No, I think we got a bit sort of high on it. I mean, we were such a weird gang of people, really, when I look back on it.
Yeah, well, because I remember seeing Danber and Boff in Harrogate in about 1980, 81, maybe 81 it was. And there were these two guys in this park, and they were dressed in tutus, and they had a ghetto blaster next to them. It was playing... She Loves You, yeah. And they were miming to Beatles songs.
Well, that's what they used to do.
It was staggering because they were so kind of, they were really intimidating looking young
men.
Well,
when I said they were busking in Paris, they were busking in Paris to other people's songs with a ghetto blaster. In dresses.
Sort of miming.
In dresses at a point where, you know, men didn't wear dresses.
Oh, yeah, no, they were pretty young guys, but they're wearing tutus, ballet. Then you're really going to get hurt.
Well,
possibly.
That were what they were like. When I met them, they were from Burnley as well. And they were like grammar school boys. And I'd never met a group of people like that before. I'd never met the clever lads. You know what I mean? I'd always been attracted to sort of clever but rough.
Yeah,
I'd never met anybody that had stayed on at school. Well, I'm sure I had met people who stayed on at school, but not like this bunch who were punks and read books and tried to do arty things. And they were life-saving, really, because at that point I just took loads of drugs and I'm around with wrong people. And I went out with Midge and I turned out to be more popular.
Who's
than
Midge?
Him. He was one of the original ones.
Okay.
But I were more popular than him, so when we finished, I stayed and he left, which is not...
So how many was in the band? Was it like a... Did it change? Was it a collective and stuff?
It were a collective, but I think if you lived in the house at that point, you got a chance to be in a band, because it wasn't like, oh, we're a group of musicians. As it turned out, a couple of them were really good musicians.
So is this the house? Is this Carcroft?
Yeah, Carcroft in Armley. We squatted it. I think late 81, maybe start of 82, and we squatted it because the band who lived there, the Mirror Boys, they'd gone off to...
The Mirror Boys. I went to see the Mirror Boys. I loved them. There were two great bands in Leeds at that time. There was the Mirror Boys and the Prowlers, and I loved the Mirror Boys, and I was so frightened by Jeff Clout, by this...
Yes.
He was fearsome, and he'd come on in these crazy sort of like gold jackets and stuff, and he had this great hook nose
and huge face.
Oh man, yeah, but he's really pretty, really striking, looked like kind of Iggy Pop's mutant fucking father.
Yeah.
There was Julian Walker on guitar.
Yeah.
And Julian, they were really good musicians. They were really strange, really ambitious, and I thought, oh god, this is the band I'd love to be in, you know.
Well, but we looked at them as, they were a bit older than us, and we looked at them as in, why they know exactly what's going on, and they went to Paris busking but to say they didn't know what was going on, they didn't really look after their house. They left a fruitarian called Jasper looking after it. He went a bit bonkers and then
somebody who lives on fruit, a fruitarian.
Yeah. In 1981, someone who lives on fruit is quite unusual.
Yeah.
And he went a bit crazy. Lived in a car in the front garden, and it weren't that big a front garden, and left the front door open and let people just come in and take whatever they want, and at the same time joined a cult. So while they were away, somebody had nicked the stairs banisters and the gas pipes. We were looking for a squat, and we thought, oh, we know, we'll squat their house. So we moved into Mirror Boy's house while they were on tour.
Oh my god.
Because they had more or less just abandoned it. You know, they were sort of like mad jazz musicians that didn't play jazz.
It was like kind of jazz, punk, kind of art school.
Yeah, art school.
Yeah, it was you could hear them, they were a bit noodly, but they were interesting and, yeah. and they had ideas and they weren't frightened to look silly.
So, and I think they'd moved out, but I'm not entirely sure. But anyway, when they came back, we lived in their house and we completely took it over, so they didn't really have a chance. Julian ended up moving back in, Julian Walker.
Yeah, yeah.
With Sarah Roy, she's the woman that were in the band for a while. Can you remember her? She played trumpet.
Sarah, oh, Sarah, yeah, because she comes to Glastonbury, I see her at Glastonbury, and I just remember, she always looked a bit like a mucky face.
Well, she was like, she was like almost farming stock.
Yeah, she did, she sort of like she'd been rudder. Dragged through a hedge.
Yeah, 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 that's, so Julian and Sarah sort of moved in with us, but they weren't in the band, and everybody else who lived there were, four of us were from Burnley. Harry and Maeve came to our house when they were 15. They were another band from Barnsley and ended up living with us. We got permission off the parents to move in with us.
So, and you were signing on, presumably?
Yeah, we were signing on. And sometimes when it got difficult, we did enterprise allowance scheme. Remember that? We passed the same £1,000 round a big group of people in Leeds. I don't know who it belonged to. Because you had to have £1,000 to start a business.
Yeah.
They didn't really watch where it went afterwards. It was when they were trying to get people off the dole. And we went. I went on it twice. Once as a sewer. I can't remember what I went on it the other time as. But basically, the dole didn't bother you. You got paid £40 a week, which were more than the dole. And you had a year to start your own business.
It's crazy.
Nobody were running their own businesses at that point.
Yeah, that was a lot of money then, though. £40 a week in sort of like 1980. That was 82.
Because
I remember I was staying in a flat then, and I was paying about £6 a week or something for the rent.
Yeah.
So you had a lot of money. You know.
It was probably closer to mid 80s enterprise allowance, but we all pooled our money anyway. When we moved in together, I'm sure some people would dispute this, but I think it's true. We wanted to be crass. Because we all instantly became vegetarians and then vegans. We all wore black. We painted everything in the house black, and we went instantly to sharing money and sharing food and sharing cooking. So we became like
a cult.
Cult commune, yeah.
Yeah.
And that lasted a lot of years.
Right.
But, I mean, it was a really good, if weird, experience. I mean,
sure.
I stayed in that house for nearly 20 years.
That's a long time to be in a house, you know, because most people, especially if you're kind of a bunch of people who aren't, like, married or sort of bound to it, sort of legally. If you've got a, it's sort of a, it's almost like a rest home. It's there. It's kind of a, it's not threatening. It's just a kind of a big kind of womb or something.
Well, it was a bit like a bit like that sometimes, and other times it was utterly vicious, because if you pressure cooker people into one house where they share everything, then you're going to see the worst and the best of them.
Of course, yeah. Because with Chumbawamba, How did the band start? I mean, what made you decide to sort of become a band?
I was the worst poet ever. I wanted to be in a band. I wanted to be something without, you know, wasn't musical at all. But I really wanted to be part of something. So I were in a band in Burnley. I played drums really badly.
You were in a band called Ow, My Hair's on Fire.
I were, yes.
Which is amazing. That ranks with what's the other? Could. That's a great name. But Ow, My Hair's on Fire, and then Chumbawamba. Yeah.
But the main thing were, I think, that to be in Chumbawamba, you had to be like bursting with ideas rather than, you know, it were never necessary. Talent weren't featured. It were lucky if anybody had any. But you had to be. We all wanted to do stuff, so somebody would buy
it was about attitude. Then.
Yeah, about attitude. Somebody would buy a fanzine one day. 3 days later, they'd be writing their own. You know, yeah. You'd see like a poet on stage, you'd think, oh, I can do that.
So you were like kind of, it was basically the punk ethic. It was, like,
yeah.
You know, learn three chords and you're in a, but you can make yeah. a band. And also it's a DIY. Oh yeah, let's make a fanzine. Let's do sniffing.
Well, and at first we just used to all swap instruments.
On stage?
On stage, yeah, right. Yeah. People would all play different things, which were really good when people were good at that.
But the instruments invariably would find themselves to the person who could play the best.
Yeah.
Oh, look, he's on bass. Oh, he's quite
good. I mean, I've seen pictures. We were still doing that in 87, or no, 86, I think. Yeah. But obviously that stopped happening. But we were basically, we weren't just a band, so we were like we went to loads of demos together. We shared a lot of the things about living in the house.
Mm-hmm.
And we were a bit like a guerrilla unit.
Mm-hmm.
And
so it was a kind of a siege mentality.
Yeah,
you
completely.
Against the rest
us
of the
us against the world. And yeah. And I think it were really us against the world till the miners' strike, when we started to do loads of miners' stuff and working with other groups.
Yeah.
But
and that was 84.
84, 85.
Right. Yeah.
So we were more of a political unit. Well, as much of a political unit as a band. So we never took money from gigs for years. I don't think we started taking money from gigs until 91.
So living off, basically off the state, as it were?
Dole, yeah.
Dole, and then you were just doing loads of freebie gigs?
We did, all our gigs were free. Everything we played were benefits. We would take petrol money, and sometimes people complained about that.
Right.
You know, it...
And you'd go to...
I don't mean we complained. I mean, sometimes the organiser complained because we wanted petrol money. Yeah. I mean, it was such a...
Yeah.
Puritan yeah. thing.
But then you'd go abroad as well. You'd go to, you know, wherever.
Yeah, we'd go abroad. That were generally benefits as well, but we would get our...
Transport and stuff.
We'd get transport and travel covered and stay on people's floors. Stayed on people's floors for a lot of years.
Right.
But we met bands like The X. Do you know The X?
They're from America, them, aren't they?
No, they're from Holland. X. They're absolutely brilliant. They're one of the best live bands I've ever seen. And they're still playing.
Right.
I mean, they do really weird things. They do things like drive across Ethiopia, playing in villages just because they want to.
Wow.
Right, yeah.
You know, they've got like an ethos of... They've gone from being punk band, 1980-81,
mm-hmm.
to now sort of punk jazz band, but with exactly the same ethos. It's had a rolling cast of members, but about three of them are the same people. They're just really interesting. But they had a fire engine, and we used to travel in their fire engine.
Excellent.
Yeah. So I don't think you could have them experiences now. Well, you couldn't be in a band because unless your parents are well off, you can't get the dole money to be creative.
I know, but the thing is, like, you know, there's like weeds, you know, you know there's people survive.
No, people
there's,
will
you know,
do it.
People will, you know, and I understand because I come from, I'm slightly older than you, I was 60, a good way older than you, and I went to art college, and my dad shoveled concrete, and I managed to get a discretionary grant. So
I started at art college, but I only did one term because I didn't know what I was doing when I got there. Again, a discretionary grant.
Yeah,
for
but I
just went to see bands.
I was there. I was there going watching the Rocky Horror Picture Show three or four times at Bradford at Alhambra, the cinema there. I took and then buy Sobrani cigarettes, but I had some money, and I got to learn about Andy Warhol and about Renoir and fucking Fellini and stuff.
Yeah.
And I came from, my mum and dad were poor. I had a grammar school background, but I came out with two O levels. I was complete. It was a nightmare. I hated school. I didn't understand it. I was kicked from pillar to post. And it took me coming out of school to kind of find my way. And I did lots of crap jobs. But then I got a grant and I got on the dole as well. I did bits of dough. So there was a certain, but. And I, and my kids have to were paying for university, you know. And well, to me, that's criminal.
Well, similar. I mean, my mum was a nurse, which was unheard of where I live. But my dad were a petrol pump attendant. Mm-hmm. You know, he used to put petrol in people's cars.
Yeah, yeah.
Or he was on the dole.
Manual. Petrol pump.
Yeah, manual. You know, he did have. When he had jobs in factories, that were like a step up. But he never lasted. He never really liked work. Yeah, I mean, you can blame him, really.
Yeah, yeah. No, it said that you left school with precious little sort of qualifications.
Yeah, I left school at 15.
And you didn't get on with your dad. Well, it's similar. I didn't get on with my dad either. But I say we managed to find some kind of life.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting because a lot of the time you don't think you are going to. You just think, I'm going to die. I'm going to end up topping myself. And I don't know what I am. But sooner or later...
Did you reach a point in your life where you thought, oh, I'm a whole person, and it's quite a shock?
Well, I did. I reached a point in my life where I drew somebody's picture. I drew somebody's portrait in biro, and I suddenly felt like I'd got my jacket. I thought, this is what I'm a portrait artist.
Yeah.
I felt and I exhaled because I thought, I can live now because. I'm good at this. I'm really good at this. I was 27, and I did my portrait in this laundrette of a friend of mine, and it was such a shock. But and then that kind of gave me confidence to kind of go out and try other things. And you said something about after you left the band that you went on to do writing, but the sound of people clapping for you. Gave me so much confidence to try other things.
Well, it did. It
if
gave
people
you,
clap
yeah,
for you.
Yeah, yeah. It does. It give you.
Yeah.
It. I mean, I always thought deep down I was a writer, but you know why I thought that, and it came from one good school report when I were about 12, that said you know I had an extraordinary command of the English, and I clung to that.
I bet. Yeah.
I clung to that. Yeah, like
it's a great review.
Yeah, yeah.
You can still use it in sort of the gig.
Yeah,
Chumbawamba playing Bolshevik. Alice Nutter, extraordinary command of the English language.
Whatever I did, I had this thing on my back thinking, one day this is what I want to do. And I never, I'm a natural in a gang, but I'm not a natural musician. So
yeah.
I could survive in a band because I'm one of them people that, I'll do the shit work, I'll go to post office, I'll do the crap that needs doing quite
keep
happily.
Keep the oil the
yeah,
wheels
yeah.
Of the machine. Yeah.
And I were under no illusions of, I never, as it turned out, I knew how to be on stage. I've always had a lot of energy and I could throw myself into it. But I never had any delusions of.
Your ability.
Of my ability, you know.
Technical ability.
It was like I could hypnotise people into thinking I were good.
Yeah.
But I always had this thing in my head, oh, actually, I think there's this thing that if I put the graft in, I could be really good at.
Yeah.
And I wrote all the way through being in the band, whether it were articles or stories. And I ended up working for Leeds of the Paper as features editor at one point.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was always real graft, you know. So I had to work out where to put the full stops. You know, I went and did an A-level at 27 and things like that to try and work out the technical side of it. But I always knew at some point I'm going to stop this and I'm going to do that. And have you heard all this before, Mark?
No, I haven't, No, it, like you said about Leeds Other Paper, I used to buy that because...
Oh, my front door's going.
Yeah. Right,
do you mind if I...
I don't mind, no, we're just going to stop there.
Yeah, sorry.
Alice's front door's going.
And I've also got toilet, so I won't be breaking up.
Get it running.
Edit it out.
Yeah, we're still here, folks. We're just rustling some paper. Did you write the songs? Do you ever... All right. What have you done? Who are you? What's
when
your name?
You decide to...
Alice. Where did Alice come from?
We're in Sansa Worthley right now.
Yeah, it's all right. Oh my god.
Oh, I feel like it.
Well, if if you drop off, Johnny, I don't mind.
I don't mind either.
And if you want to chime in as well, I don't mind. You know.
I'm enjoying it, listening. Yeah. Yeah. I might chip in. I feel the moment's right.
Yeah. I don't know what time it is.
It's 2:30, 2:45.
Have you got your phone on you?
Yeah. Why?
Because we started at whatever time, 2:15 or something.
That's fine.
I suppose you'll just ramble on. We don't need to.
I don't even know what I was saying. Sorry.
You look at this.
Did your air level at 27?
Oh yeah, I did an air level at 27.
That's the time when you either get to take a shotgun to your head like Kurt Cobain, or else you start. I remember at 27 thinking, I'm going to die. I'm probably going to die because I feel shit. I better kill myself. But luckily, I then ended up drawing somebody, and I didn't.
Well, I never really felt depressed.
Uh-huh.
But I did feel like I were not doing the thing I should be doing. So when I say that, I didn't feel depressed, that's not true. I felt pissed off, but not to a point where I didn't want to go on. I think I felt frustrated. But at the same time, because I'd ended up in this gang, and they are really nice people, and it stopped me taking drugs, and it stopped me being wild, really. Although, you know, obviously we did take drugs again sometimes.
So were you slightly older than them than
No, I'd had a much wilder life than most of them.
So were you kind of, did you feel like you were some kind of like mother figure
No.
Was there a sort of a power thing?
No, not really. I felt like I'd lived
more. And you had more experience than them.
I felt like
they were more like kids.
Yeah.
Okay.
Although I didn't feel like a grown up, I just knew I'd have more fuck ups. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, I get that.
So I just knew I'd had more fuck ups, and their experience weren't the same as mine. So, you know, they're my really dear friends.
Yeah.
But, you know, I took so many drugs by the time I met them, and I'd had a hard time at home. And my dad had tried to put me into care when I was 13. You know, he took me down and said, I don't want to. You know. Mm-hmm. So I'd had like a quite...
A hard childhood.
Yeah, I'd had a hard childhood, really. Yeah. And I'm not saying that other people hadn't, but it just didn't seem quite as weird as mine.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, life got weirder. You know, when you and Chumbawamba were there, I mean, because it's quite a strange space to have. Like, you've got these creative people, and you're in this kind of commune, whatever sort of thing for like 20 years. We used to live in there. Like, 20 years later.
Well, I lived there 18 years. I was the last. I was like Miss Havisham. I've only lived in two houses in Leeds. Don't like change.
I don't. I like my little routine. I can set in fire to libraries.
You know, I've got more. I've still got friends that I had when I were a kid. I mean, they're absolute lunatics.
Yeah.
But
most are. Most people's friends, you know, are lunatics. Yeah.
But I tend to stick at things.
Mm. So, well, it's what you know, isn't it? Yeah. Better the devil you know than the devil you don't. Yeah.
So other people went off before me, but I don't think I was a mother figure, but I were always pretty capable, you know, in terms of, I'd always worked really hard. And if there were a job to be done, I'd sort of do it. And I worked out that that made you necessary in a band.
Yeah.
You know, the person who does the crap sometimes. I'm not saying I did all crap.
Yeah. No, it kind of, it's noticed. Maybe not sort of, there's an unspoken understanding that this person is prepared to dig deep and is a stayer and has some kind of substance.
Yeah, and also...
You know, even if you're not particularly, you know, even if you can't sing...
Well, lose my best friend. you know, Lou and Harry are still my best friends, but Lou has got a brilliant voice, but she's never recognised it. And I wouldn't have given anything to be able to do what she did. And I don't think I would have been a writer if I'd had a natural, the natural thing that she had.
But you knew, you kind of innately knew that sort of you had something else. You know, this worked. It was a good situation, but at the same time, there was another area that needed kind of unearthing. Working on.
And I think if you do anything, and you're determined to do anything really well, when you first start it, you think you're brilliant. You think whatever you do is brilliant, and then you quickly realise it's shit, and you've got to put absolute.
It's not shit. It's not bad. It's quite good.
Yeah, but you know what I mean. That it's nowhere near good enough, and that's when you have to start to be really, you know, to be a good guitarist, to be a songwriter, which is what you are. You have to put the hours in.
It's a discipline. Yes,
it's a discipline. So, you've got to do, and so when I finally moved from that to writing, I completely attacked it as a discipline. You know, this is, I knew I had a certain amount of talent, but I thought, well, that's not going to be enough.
No, it isn't. No, there's the hours afterwards.
Yeah, and there's the everyday sitting down and the saying you'll do something and doing it wrong and then rewriting it and then and I'd sort of learnt that, you know, to even write songs when you're not particularly musical is not an easy thing. And I'd done that. You know, I were always a trier. So when you find the thing you can actually do, you don't mind the graft.
Mm. Yeah. And when you were writing, who wrote the songs? Were you all like bringing songs from together, or did you work together on like some of the new?
I mean, we were really weird. We'd sit down and we'd say, "What's this album going to be about?" There were normally like a concept going round of what it might be, and we'd all decide as a group. Even people who didn't write songs completely, I would say. And then about four of us would go away and write words.
So who was that? You and Boff and
And Dan and Dunst. And then Boff would edit the words down musically. Do you know what I mean? So you'd write words and he'd mix it with the tunes. But quite often, to make it easier, you'd write the words to a different song. So you'd write it to the tune of a Beat Bop a Looba or something. So you knew you'd have the rhythm.
Oh, yeah.
And then he'd take it and put it to that rhythm. So we all decided the concept together. About four of us would write the words, but then other people were completely involved in the music. And it depended what it was, but people had different skills. So we lasted so long as a band, I think, because people were really interested. So, for instance, Harry were really interested in music. So he learned electronic music pretty early on. He learned programming. And he took us in a different direction.
Yeah.
And then Boff were interested in folk, and so he pushed it towards folk. And because people had all these
strengths and paths
that they were on, people would push it along one way, and other people who were interested in ideas would push it another way. And I were always interested in ideas. I've always read. I've always.
So what were you? What kind of stuff were you reading when you were like just kind of maybe leaving school? Then, you know, when you.
I've been a reader all my life. My mum used to take me to the library from being 5, 6.
Right.
So we didn't have books in our house, but.
So
we
was it kind of was it novels or was it kind of.
Starting on all the sort of children's classics.
Yeah.
So, you know, I read Alice in Wonderland really young, all the Enid Blyton stuff, and then.
I read all the Enid Blytons. I had the collection, and I think there was five go to
Mallory Towers. I wanted to go to boarding school, you know what I mean? I was desperate to go to boarding school.
Living in Beeston, aren't I?
Yeah. I live in a two-up, two-down in Burnley.
Oh, my God, they're having buns here.
Exactly. Oh, God, there's another midnight feast.
So then, as you're older,
I went on to sort of older classics. I read all the J.D. Salinger and all that sort of stuff. And then when I met kids who went to art school, I did a foundation course and I did a term at art school. And
so what, when you do, was you, were you a drawer? Or
yeah. I mean, I can draw.
Okay. So who, did you do like some of the artwork for the Chumbawamba?
No, I can't draw like that.
So and when I'm you not say a, draw, what do you draw?
I mean, I could do life drawings and I've got a good sense of colour.
Okay.
But so I wanted to be an artist at one point. But again, I never really felt like that was my thing. But yeah, I was always full of ideas. So I do things like throw seeds over my shoulder, well, throw sticks and where they fall. I'd plant seeds and then see what came up 6 months later. You know, I do, you know, I get all the fur coats and turn them into animals. I do whatever. I just like making things. And I wanted to be a fashion designer. I used to make all my own clothes. We're quite good at that.
So was that with the band as well?
No, that was way before I've been making my own clothes since.
So you were dabbling, you were a bit of a sort of renaissance.
Yeah. I made my own clothes from being about 14 because I went to Wigan Casino. And so I used to make, you know, I'd make full circle skirts and...
So you're at Northern Soul and stuff?
Yeah, I was really into Northern Soul. Uh-huh. And speed.
Yeah,
which is not good for your long term.
Neither I didn't. I mean, I was reading an article about a mate of mine called John Barrett, who's he taught at Leeds Art College, and he was completely obsessed with Northern Soul. And he used to take me to these all nighters and stuff, and to Gilderson. I don't know, you know, Brig House and the various other places.
I mean, I loved it as a kid because it was a complete escape from our house.
So this, how old were you when you were going to these?
14. 14, and I used to hitch everywhere.
So you'd be coming home after midnight, wouldn't you be?
I'd be coming home next day, absolutely off my tits.
Oh, and no, what about, would your mum and dad not
Well, it were hell in our house anyway, so it couldn't really make it much worse. You know what?
All right, okay, yeah.
You know, I had a really difficult relationship with my dad, and even if I behaved myself, he wasn't particularly...
Yeah.
Nice to me. So I went completely the other way, which is...
So which is what you do.
Which is what you do.
Yeah, I virtually similar things. I remember dressing up in my mum's clothes and going, I think it was like a New Year's night, and I had, you know, Cardi and stuff and slip and mules and stuff and just old shit, old stockings, and went sat down next to my dad on the couch and we watched like kind of whatever, Hogmanay, Hoopmanay, whatever night.
Yeah.
And he sat there and he was a really fearsome, intimidating guy, but and he was completely freaked. He just sat there and he said nothing. And I sat with him on the couch, dressed as my mum, for about, I don't know, maybe half an hour, or an hour or something, and then got up and left. Because I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to kind of please him.
Yeah, I think I got on with my dad best once when I was completely off my head on mushrooms. I came in, we were watching Charlie's Angels, and I remember having a really long conversation with him when I was completely tripping. And I remember thinking, oh, that went well.
But back on the mushrooms, that's the solution.
But generally, no.
Yeah. So after your Chumbawamba, you left Chumbawamba after 20 years, and you started to write.
Yeah,
and you went down to the West Yorkshire Playhouse and did like a writing course.
Yeah, I did that So You Want to Be a Writer course. And I knew I wanted to write drama. I'd written like a novella when I was in Chumbawamba. I never did anything with it, but I knew I could do it. But what I realised pretty soon is, oh my God, I'm going to have to learn structure. Because what happens is if you're doing something short...
Yes.
It's fine, you don't have to structure it, but if you're doing an essay or a piece for a paper, you have to know what your structure is, you have to know what your beginning, middle and end is.
Right.
And then suddenly I thought, oh my God, I'm gonna have to know what my beginning, middle and end is. And on top of that, I'm gonna have to get somebody to notice that I can write so that I can get paid for it.
Yeah. So this is a kind of a career move as well. You're thinking, this is my, what I'm gonna do, this is the way I'm gonna.
Were you
a mum then or something?
Yeah, I'd got May. And I'd said to Chumbawamba I was going to leave before I was 40, but I was 44 when I left.
Yeah.
You know, and people would by that point we're going, oh, I thought you were leaving when you were 40. I was like, no, I'm getting around to it. But I were in a much luckier position than most people because we'd had that hit.
Yeah, yeah.
So I had enough money.
A few doors open for you, I suppose.
Yeah, no, but I had money to fall back on. So I had enough money for 2 years.
Right, yeah, yeah.
And we used that money for Keir to get his MA.
Right.
You know, and me, I said, if I'm not earning proper money in 2 years, then I'm just gonna, I'll just get a job.
Keir's
my partner, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
And what was he doing?
He was a removal man at that point.
And he was studying what? So what was the MA for?
Politics, and he became a university lecturer. So we put our money into him doing an MA and a PhD.
So we're going to be interviewing him next week. Then, yeah, from removals to politics, to it. Crikey, yeah. It's mad, isn't it? Isn't life crazy? You go from, yeah, wonderful. So anyway, so you were learning about structure and writing, and you had some cash.
But I had to. What I realised pretty soon is that you have to get people to realise you can do this thing, because it's all right having done something else before.
Yeah.
Might open doors, but they'll shut if you can't write.
Yeah.
You know, no one's going to spend the money putting anything on if you can't come up with the goods. It's too expensive a thing, and it's too difficult a thing.
And you were probably aware that, because that's the, you know, you're in a band, you're in a kind of an interesting, glamorous, exotic kind of profession, but you know that sort of, it's a lot of it is unpleasant lifting and bending, and it's discipline.
It's getting the,
so you knew that that's going to happen. If you're going to be a writer, there's going to be a lot of kind of stuff under the surface of like sweating, straining, you know, pushing. And
same as getting the gear into the house at 4 a.m. is like being in a band. Yeah. You know that.
Yeah.
You know, they're arriving back absolutely
knackered and
having
speechless.
And having to sort of get it all in, and then having to get up next morning to do it again because you're going somewhere else.
Yeah, but
I knew it'd be, well, I weren't worried about hard work, but I knew that I had to learn fast. If I were only giving myself two years to be earning a living,
yeah,
I just thought, I've got to hit the ground running here. And by being so old, I were ruthlessly focused, and I did whatever I had to do. So I did that play that you took part in. Mm-hmm. But that Where's Vietnam?
Yeah.
And I'd done, me and Harry got a Arts Council grant to do like a thing in Bradford, and everything I did, I just learnt as I went along.
Mm. So, and you were making, people were coming in the door paying money to see a show.
Yeah.
And you were getting, so you were getting something as well.
Yeah, no, I were, and
so you were learning in public.
Learning in public, and I did, and so what I did is I tried to do a couple of Arvon courses. Arvon. So they're like writer's courses. You pay for a 5-day course, and then you do a residential with somebody who can write.
Right.
So I did one with a radio producer. She noticed me, and I got offered a radio play later on from that. I did a TV one with Jimmy McGovern, and he noticed I could write, because he basically said at the end of the week, an unusual thing's happened. I found two professional footballers, which were me and another woman, who's also gone on to be a writer. You know, I found two people who could do this.
Yes, yes.
And he offered me to pitch for The Street, and I got it. And so I had an episode of The Street. And I started to work on other people's
shows. So when you
say
pitch for this, because you're selling a...
You've got to go in, and if you're pitching for a show like that, which has got standalone episodes in a thing, you have to come up with a story.
Yeah.
So you have to go along and say, you know, there's this story about a lonely window cleaner. Who's
he's
a poet
suffering from Alzheimer's? Yeah. He's only 27.
exactly. And
his wife.
And he falls in love with his auntie, and his uncle kills him. Whatever it is.
Yeah.
And you've got to find one. You have like about an hour of throwing stories at them where they just shake their head.
So what, there's a guy, you're standing in the middle
people.
Of the room and there's a,
no, you sat down with them, there's about three people.
And they sit there quietly.
You're blabbing, splurging, right. Chucking ideas at them and then they shake their head and then you go, and then I've got another one.
Yeah.
And I did all this for about an hour and I ain't got one and they were like shaking their head. And I said, and then there's this other one I thought on the train here and my last one worked because I said, you know,
well done.
I've got a story about... Yeah. Postman who steals letters and teaches a lad who can't read to read, and they went, oh, that sounds interesting, go away and write a page on what it might be, and I got it. So I'm gonna said yeah. Got my first hour of
so,
TV.
So Jimmy McGovern sent you to do that, did he?
I did it in front of, basically I pitched in front of Jimmy McGovern, the producer and the script editor.
Yeah.
And when I finally did the Postman one, which were end of me tether, he went, yeah, I like that one, write us a page on that and see what. So then I went, you know, page beginning, middle, end, this is what I'm going to be, and this is... And went back to see him, and they said, yeah, okay, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So then you do... So then I had an hour of TV, and it went like that. It went that... and I ended up working with Jimmy quite a few times, because... And that's sort of how it's been for me, really. I work with somebody.
Deliver. You deliver the goods and
then it becomes an ongoing relationship. Yeah, so yeah. I've been working with I can't even say his name. I've been working with
Simon de Beauvoir.
Yeah, Simon Beaufoy.
Simon Beaufoy.
but you know, I worked with him on something and it went really well and I've ended up working on all these TV things since then.
And he's worked on what, Simon?
So he did Slumdog Millionaire, Full Monty. But I did Trust with him. And then we started a sci-fi thing for FX, which we ended up not doing. And I can't say what it is, but we've written 5 eps of an austerity comedy drama that we just wait to see if we get
greenlit. So you're having a go at comedy as well?
Yeah, comedy drama, but I've always done a bit of that.
Okay. Yeah, I've liked some of the titles of the Chumbawamba stuff, some of the stuff that they come out with, you know, there's some really... Some good use of language, anyway.
Yeah,
I like some of the way they present things in there. I like that full of shit. I really like that.
Yeah, mate. The thing about Chumbawamba is that we were sort of always reacting to stuff. We were always provocative. I don't think I'm particularly provocative about what I'm doing now. I'm trying to tell stories about how difficult it is to be human. You know,
yeah,
and the struggle
yeah.
and what people have to go through, but I'm trying to do it in a way that's not completely miserable.
Yeah. Do you think that was what you were doing when you were in Chumbawamba? You were completely miserable.
I just spat there.
You walked into that one.
Yeah.
We'll cut
yeah,
that
but
out.
No. I think I was probably one of the most earnest ones of us for a long time. But it's a bit because it was like religion to me. In that I'd lived this sort of wild, you know, I should have died really, how many drugs I took and people I mixed with. I'd lived this sort of wild, sometimes difficult life.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying my mum didn't love me, because she did, but you know, life's difficult.
Yeah.
But, and then when I found that, which felt like a safe haven.
Yeah, so you were some kind of like, whatever, Chumbawamba, like the kind of the... You had your Damascus.
Yeah,
it
was a bit like a religious experience. You know, it was really important.
And it was healthy because it gave you some structure and it kind of you had.
There were safe people to be with. You weren't going to wake up raped. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was
solid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they're good people.
Yeah, I remember getting a shock. I ran a marathon and I sort of and I'm just waiting there. I'd never done them before, but I'm sort of standing there, and there's a guy in front of me with an anarchist shirt on his and it was Boff.
Yeah.
And I thought, he's in that band, that Chumbawamba, but they don't do stuff like marathons.
The thing is, they did. Boff and Dan especially, they always had like things that they love doing outside the band. We just weren't like a normal rock and roll band at all.
Uh-huh. So you'd be going off, and when you weren't having gigs, you know, have your own life, and you wouldn't be sort of tied to Carcrofts.
No, we were, yeah.
You were tied
for
to
a
Carcrofts.
Long time, yeah. Well, I mean, we didn't really have our own lives for a long time.
So it was a hive then?
Yeah, it was like a hive. I mean, I don't think we had our own lives until... People started to move out about 94, but we were still really close-knit. We still, if we went to a club, we all went to a club together.
What clubs did you go to?
Well, we went to nightclubs and stuff.
No, but where?
We went to Vague and, you know, Kit Kat Club or... Yeah, we tended to... So, if we went to a gig, we went to a gig together. If we were, you know, Louie's still my best friend.
Yeah.
Still
yeah.
My, you know, I've got a lot of friends, but she's still
I mean, surely you must have sort of got a bit tired. And God, I just, you'd have a little holiday from each other every now and again.
Well, when I moved in here, because this is the house I moved into, A, I couldn't believe I lived in such a nice house. But B, it was such a relief not to have a meeting about everything. Could just make a decision and do it without having a meeting. I was so sick of meetings.
Yeah. So that's presumably for everything then.
We'd have a meeting for it. And we had a rule which was we didn't vote on anything. We had to just talk other people into submission.
Yeah.
We just talked at them until someone agreed or relented.
So did you
so
play?
You were there hours.
I don't know where to go with that. I really. I'm looking here at. Did you used to play places like the Duchess then?
We played the Duchesses last night because we played the Duchess. You know, the night before it closed down.
All right.
Because we played the Duchess all the way through.
All right.
We started off. We've played everywhere.
So you'd be playing the 1 in 12 club.
Oh God,
as well.
We played the 1 in 12 club.
That was
many times.
Because I remember seeing you at Chumbo 1 in 12, Chumbo 1.
We raised money and we helped paint it. You know, when they got the new building, we went in and did help with the plastering and stuff.
Right. Yeah.
But we played everywhere. I don't think there's a town that puts gigs on that we haven't played at some point. Mm-hmm. And then about 91, we said, okay, we're giving everything away and we're all having to do really crap jobs. Harry were working in an old folks home, shoveling shit. Lou were a car mechanic. I worked at Suma.
Yeah.
And it was like, this is insane. We can only gig at weekend because we're working all week. If we took money for gigs and we did that full time, we wouldn't have to do these crap jobs. And
so you had a meeting about that then?
Yeah, we had a massive meeting. Right. And I'd just gone to Brett Knoll. I'd done my A-level.
Yeah.
And I'd gone to Brett Knoll and I'd done a year of a creative writing thing. And then the thing was we all had to either commit to it or stop it.
To the band?
To the band, yeah.
Yeah.
That were like, we're going to stop just playing at weekends. It's going to be...
A career.
It's going to be our thing. We're going to try it. And so I gave up college, which I've never regretted.
Yeah, this is, you get what, Bretton Hall you get?
Yeah, yeah, we're 28 then.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, and that was the first time we took money. Mm. And we paid £60 a week, we all got each. But then the van came out of it as well, and, you know, we still had communal money. And and we just pulled everything. So all the songwriting credits went to everybody.
Right.
You know, we did it all as a...
Mm-hmm. So...
Everybody got equal shares.
And there was no... Did the advent of money, did that cause issues?
No.
Not at all? Not
no. Like... I mean, people think money's going to be a problem, but money was never our problem. Housework. People's... attitudes to things, you know, would be more of a problem than money, because you can't spend all them years with people without them getting on your wicks.
Of course, yeah, no, they're all the little, yeah. The
yeah, but whatever. No, never money. And when we did make a lot of money, we gave a lot of it away.
Yeah.
So then we did a thing where if we took an ad, we'd give the money from the ad. So we did a Ford ad, and we gave all the money to Corporate Watch in America to watch Ford. You know,
right. Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
We do.
Yeah, I saw that there was
and you turn down, like, was it Nike? Yeah. They wanted to use Tub Thumper. Yeah. And they offer you 1.5 million.
No, just a million.
A million, it says 1.5.
Yeah, a million. But whatever. But the money were never the problem. And I think money were never the problem because we shared it equally. I think if we hadn't shared it equally, there would have been resentment about it.
Yeah.
No, money, people think that's where your arguments will lie. But we'd been sharing everything for so long that, you know, your arguments lie when people's attitudes change. And it were right that our attitudes changed at different times. Mm. It were weird, really. I mean, basically, I lived in a gang for a lot of years.
So do you think all of you you've all come out of it sort of better people? Not better people. Like there's Lou and there's Harry and there's Boff and that. Do you think that if you hadn't have been in that band, that you would have been maybe you wouldn't have been as strong, maybe?
No, I wouldn't have had. If I hadn't been in that band, I wouldn't have had the confidence or to go on and have the life I had. And if I hadn't met that group of people, I can't say what it did for other people, but I know for me, it gave me a huge amount of security emotionally, you know, and having a group of friends like that and having people clap and think you're good. So when you were talking to Keith Allen about your dad's never saying good things to you, if you get validation from people in the world, I think it's really good for your soul. But it's not good if you get too much and it's not, you know, it's not deserved. Mm. What I'm trying to say is that I never thought I were a great musician. So I got validation, but I didn't think, oh, I'm brilliant, mate. I just thought, oh, I'm really lucky this thing's going on.
Yeah. Yeah. Now that, well, I'm just thinking, it's wonderful to get claps. It's wonderful to get praise and stuff. And
well, it's like drugs, isn't it? It's better than coke.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's a real. It's intoxicating. Yeah. And it's kind of a bit dodgy. You just have to be careful because it kind of you can't live on that. And that's because the thing is, it's like that's just about people are clapping. What's happening in front of them, which is a song or a piece of theatre or something, you're making that stuff, so you can't confuse that with this. They're not clapping you, they're clapping
that
the communal
thing.
Experience.
Well, what I think as I've got older, what I've realised, what I want is the validation of my peers. So I'm not talking about people I don't know in the world, but you want people who you respect to respect you, and it's that simple. And everyone should get that, regardless of whether they have a creative endeavour in life. You want to treat people with respect, and that respect to get back.
And you're not kind of expecting people to sort of automatically applaud you because you turn up at an award ceremony. It's really nice when you get something from out of left field, you get a letter saying, some guy just sent us a text at the weekend saying, I've just discovered your gonzo stuff.
Yeah.
Squire from Leeds, he said. And he said, you've got me through 2 suicide attempts and a hit and run.
Yeah.
And the cure was that song, that Plastic Fox. He said, it's just done more for me, that song. And my daughter loves it. She's 8. And we both still don't know all the words. We keep getting confused. But
it's to be important in somebody's life. That is huge. You can't underestimate that. But I think what is really crap about being in a band is that when you walk into a room and you get more attention than anybody else because you're in a band, and that bit, luckily, I never craved it. Mm. And when we had, you know, when we were number one in America, I was really miserable. I was really miserable. Because I just thought, oh, I don't like this.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't make me think,
It's a little bit of a... I think I'm really happy to get cheered and get sort of praise and stuff. But I remember doing a kind of a comedy show in Edinburgh, and I won an award, and I turned up at this kind of award ceremony, and it was a party, an after show party, and there was loads of people there. There was, you know, Paul Merton, Julian Clary, and Bob Mortimer, and this, that, and the other, and Johnny Vegas, blah, blah, and there was music playing, and it was the dullest, most soulless kind of, and I'm thinking, I'm going to go home to my brother's house, because I'll have more fun there, and this is supposed to be like kind of the mountain, the pinnacle, you're here with,
you've found your people, I don't think I'm going to come here.
I thought, these lot of, I'm not having any fun here. I'm going home. I'm going to dance around the kitchen up the road in Joppa in Edinburgh where my brother lives, because I don't feel any connection to this, and it's kind of a rude awakening. So,
but I think that's really healthy because all the fame thing, and it's not like I've had a lot of it, but I think it's really bad for your soul. I think it's really bad for you as a human being to get attention from a stranger who will then give it to the next stranger just because you're meant to stand for something. Do you know what I mean?
I got to an age where I wasn't 20, 21 to Glastonbury and stuff. I was 50, you know.
I was 36 when we.
So it's just like, I'm a dad. I was nearly a granddad.
Yeah.
So there was a certain amount of kind of cynicism.
I'm a right miserable bitch, aren't I? Really? Do you know, in terms of.
You're fine. No, you're sitting there in your summer colours and.
No, but you know, it's just like half the things that as a kid you think, you know, you sing it to airbrush and you think, oh, this is what I want. And then when it comes, you're like, oh, I don't like this.
But the thing is, this is what life's like. And we're telling the young Alice, you know, don't sort of worry too much about getting, you know, the medal, the gold medal, because it's just a piece of metal. It won't sort of fix your fridge.
Yeah.
And you can't eat it. And it's just a piece of. It's got a string on it, and you'll stick it in your cupboard.
But having said that, I, you know, when earlier on we were sort of talking about the doll, and it really pains me that working class kids can't be paid to be creative. I mean, it really pains me that all the things that people like you and me got to do, just because the doll would give us a certain amount of money, and whether that's screen printing or whether
they're not having fun
or being in a band or being a portrait artist, you had like something to fall back on to find your creative self, and that's gone.
Yeah, well, it's a crime to be poor. We're not going to give you any chance, because the thing is, you might fritter it away going off doing photography or doing fashion design or something, whereas, you know, you really need
say we're not going to give you anything because you're going to buy smack. I mean, it's bollocks,
Yeah, all you deserve is possibly some, you know, value chips, and make do with that, you know, and we'll eat the aubergines.
But I also think give people money, if they buy smack, that's their choice. You know, it's not a. We live in such a divided, strata society, and we just come from a point where the world had changed a bit. You know, 50s, 60s. My dad fought in Second World War, and I think it were there were a point where we got the National Health Service afterwards, we got free education, because people had spent all these years at war, and there would have been an insurrection if we didn't get it. And now all that memory's gone.
And it's all being swept away very gently.
Yeah.
And there's a few little scraps, some crumbs left, and it was such a wealthy sort of period, a healthy period, when I grew up in the 60s and the 70s, and I look back and think, I was blessed to have had this, to be allowed to do that too, and things like.
I think it's better for my daughter in terms of being a woman than it were then, because your options were so much. It's only now that I realise how few your options were. Have you read Viv Albertine's book?
I have,
when she's talking about that women didn't even do exercise. You know, like 70s, 80s, everything belonged to men.
Yeah, they led a mysterious sort of kind of undercover existence. You know, women, they have cornflakes. Yeah. No, they have the Kellogg's Special K. They don't have Weetabix, they have Special K because it's lighter.
And it really was like, growing up, it were like men got to do everything and we got our status from being attached to them. You know, Northern Soul were really like that. Men collected records, we were the girlfriends, you know.
So did you collect records?
No, did I? Heck, I were the girlfriend of a succession of really boring engineers who I didn't even like.
Yeah, this is it. This is all these kind of artificial hills of success. They're all just balloons. They're empty.
So at least my daughter, she doesn't. You know, I was gutted. I've said this loads of times. I'm sure you've heard it before. But I was gutted when John Lennon died because I thought, oh, I'm never going to get to marry him. Because I thought that were the absolute pinnacle of where you could be.
And then within 2 years' time, you know, fuck them all.
Yeah, exactly.
Fuck the Beatles.
But I'm so glad that my daughter ain't growing up thinking, that won't put up with the crap of having to attach yourself and to get status through what a man does. And you know, and that I grew up thinking that men were somehow cleverer than women.
Well, I grew up thinking that, you know, as a kid, and I still think it's there's still an adjustment in my head. I still kind of I'm tied to some kind of old kind of whatever.
Well, it's
attitudes.
Yeah,
and stuff.
Well, it's thousands of years of patriarchy. It becomes almost into your genes.
Yeah, it's embedded, and you just have to kind of. Luckily, I kind of met other people that talked to me and educated me, and I started to read and I say.
But
things
change. But it's life that teaches you, really.
Of course,
it is.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's not that I read a book and realised that men aren't clever others. It's, I got to a certain age and I thought, Jesus Christ, I've gone under the assumption that men somehow just know how to do a load of things that I don't know how to do. But it's actually because A, they've learnt it, and most of the time they don't know how to do these things anyway. You know, you just have these, and I'm glad, I feel that has changed. So she, you know, young people might not be able to get the doll, but the one thing that I don't think young women are growing up thinking they just have to be an appendage, and I did grow up thinking that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very strange because I just remember as a kid, my mum had a visit from my uncle Patrick, and he'd been divorced and he brought his new girlfriend round, and my mother, who is a really gentle soul and is very generous and very, and my mother turned a nose up at this woman because she was divorced, and you know, I was Irish Catholic, and the idea of divorced woman coming into the house meant that your house was basically you need to disinfect it afterwards because she was the spawn of Satan. You know, I'm thinking, and there's a bit of me, I was like 8 or 9, and I was confused because she seemed a nice woman, and yet my mother was just sort of handing her the sandwich very delicately and moving out of the room, and I'm saying, but she's nice, mum. You know, oh no, she's.
What do you know?
And well, this is it, you know, and you kind of, when you kind of get out, you realise that your parents don't sort of have this sort of the rule book of good behaviour or of how you should.
Do you think as you get older you realise your poor parents were utterly screwed up? That's what I've got to a point of, my poor parents, do you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, I mean, I look at my mum. My mum kind of, she managed. She sort of, she got through sort of conversations about David Bowie and cross dressing, and about LSD and this. And my mother wouldn't know what LSD was, but she just nodded.
Yeah, yeah.
And she was just quite sort of gentle, and she was just easy. Whereas my father, I wouldn't be able to talk about anything. Yeah. Sort of, I couldn't cross the threshold about any conversation because I'd meet. It was very really opinionated, and there wouldn't be any transaction going on. Yeah. It'd just be a case of he'd hammer me over the head with
Well, that's what it's almost like Edwardian man. Yeah. Came through. Yeah.
Well,
he was.
My father was born in 1917, so he was like, you know, he was like, my mum was 21 when he met her, and she was, and he was 37.
Yeah, my dad was born in 1916.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's the same.
It's very much. Yeah. They came up. They're from a different time.
Yeah, that's, I mean, my dad seemed so much older than everybody else's parents, yeah. Just because, yeah. You know.
He talked older. He dressed older. His manner was older. Yeah,
and he sort of thought that you could just force somebody to be exactly as you wanted it to be at that point. Anyway, I'm going on.
Yeah, right. Well, listen, I think
before we go, thank you for coming on for doing this
podcast.
Thank
you very
much. You're really
much.
Welcome. Can I just warn you? I won't listen to it because I'm not listening to myself. Because it's is that fine. All right? I'll listen to everybody else.
Okay.
I'll only be depressed if I listen to myself.
Well, we'll edit it, and Bella makes daughter all. They'll contact you when she's done the images and
okay.
stuff.
Okay, well, maybe I'll listen to
tell
it.
Tell us what you're listening to at the moment. What's the last thing that...
Musically. Music recommendations. Often,
yeah, have you got a musical recommendation that you've listened to recently? Mm. Doesn't have to be like your favourite thing, it's just something you picked up.
Do you know what? This is really awful. I'm just working and I can't listen to music, so...
Oh, yeah. I mean, even when when you finish working...
Well, I haven't listened to anything for about a month. Do you think that's terrible?
No, it's terrible. I mean, I don't.
Yeah.
When I'm
not willing to lie to you. Yeah.
No, that well, when yeah. I do, when I'm drawing, when I'm writing, when I'm painting, I have to work in silence.
Do you know what?
My mates.
Do you know what I've been listening to for joy? Robert Eichmann short stories.
I want to get some Ernest Hemingway
audiobooks. I've just bought 4 Ernest Hemingways this week. Did you watch that documentary?
Yeah, it's fucking amazing. I was just telling Mick about it, the Ken Burns one.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
Yeah,
isn't it?
See, that's what I did last week.
Yeah.
And then I bought Sun Also Rises, Death in the Afternoon, For Whom the Bell Tolls,
yeah.
And Movable Feast. To
I love
read.
That narrator's
yeah.
voice on it.
I was talking about Movable Feast.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm rubbish.
No worries, we're done now.
Thanks,
Alice, for joining us today and for keeping us topped up with sparkling water and magnums. Alice is currently working on an austerity drama/comedy. She's on Twitter at AliceNut1. You can listen to this again and download the podcast on iTunes, Mick Artistic's Ego Podcast. Further links can be found on our website, mickartistic.com. Cheers to all the people who keep tuning in. Don't forget to tell your mates and your family. And if you like what you hear, give us a review on Apple Podcasts or iTunes. It's early days, so we need all the listeners we can get to the top of the podcast charts. Fly, you beauties. Bye.